Blog Talk Radio.
We'll get into Helen Gurley Brown in a minute. A woman by the name of Lucy Stone, born in 1818. A director who used women like Kim Novak in various plays, and Grace Kelly. Alfred Hitchcock was born today. Another famous woman, cowgirl, great shooter. During the late 1800s, 19th century, Annie Oakley, born today. The inventor of the rotary engine, which was put in Mazda vehicles, German, lived during the time of Hitler, Fritz Wankel, a war criminal, Alfred von Bohlen-Krupp, he's not related to Klaus von Bülow. Krupp had, the original Krupp, Friedrich Krupp, of the great German iron and manufacturing and war cannons, like Big Bertha, a cannon that was so big it shelled Paris. It was named after Friedrich Krupp's, one of his daughters. He had four daughters, and he wanted to carry on the name, so the guy who married one of his daughters, Alfred, had to carry the name Krupp, and Krupp was a war criminal during World War II, used slave labor. He served I think 10 years in prison. He wasn't executed like some of the Japanese industrialists weren't executed also, even though they abused people that were the forced laborers in their factories, etc. Famous pianist. He was blind all his life, like Stevie Wonder. Caucasian chap, George Shearing, his birthday's today. Now, this is interesting. A lot of people think that Castro is Fidel's last name. It's not. It's Ruz, R-U-Z. And he pulled a big ruse on us. I remember I was in high school, in boarding school, and we thought, just a kid, we thought Fidel Castro was a people's hero. And our priest at the time, a guy named Father Stern, interesting man in and of himself, family made money during the Depression by buying General Motors stock. He became a priest. The family, I guess, was Jewish originally, Jewish heritage, and became a Roman Catholic priest and then decided to revert to Judaism, and he reconverted back to Judaism. Very interesting man. I've never heard of a case like that. But anyway, He told us that Fidel is a communist. You will learn. And boy, have we. And he's been the longest serving dictator in modern history. 1959. So that's, what, 53 years. Those of you who remember Hawaiian music, Don Ho, born today. Another famous black opera singer. She has quite a few temper tantrums, I understand. Kathleen Battle, very good-looking woman. The only deaths today, Otto Passman, a longtime congressman, 30 years he served in Congress, serving in more ways than one, his district in Louisiana. And then Jack Ryan, and we're going to hear a lot about Ryan's names, the name people name Ryan, whether it's the Canadian judge, whether it's the Jack Ryan who was exposed when he ran for a U.S. Senate seat in Indiana and found out he was pimping his wife. But this Jack Ryan invented the Barbie doll, and he died in 1991. Among the events today, the Spanish conquered Mexico City and abused the Mexicans, the Aztec Indians. In 1704, the English defeated the French at the Battle of Blenheim, and it was the Duke of Marlborough, who was the ancestor of Winston Spencer Churchill. Churchill's, there's the palace at Blenheim, which was named after the land grant that he got, the Duke of Marlborough, got from the king in recognition of his defeat at the French in that war. In 1831, we had the first of the slave revolts. Nat Turner, a very famous slave revolt. In fact, there's a book written by him. And, of course, he was caught and probably brutalized and then hanged. And then we had another problem with blacks, how they were abused. Teddy Roosevelt was a racist. In fact, George Washington Carver had dinner with him at the White House and tried to get T.R. to be more open try to liberalize American society's approach to treating blacks as equals and giving them civil rights. But T.R. wouldn't have any of it. I had heard that at the Battle of San Juan Hill, where Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders rode up the hill to take the hill from the Spanish in Cuba, there was a black military contingent with Teddy Roosevelt. However, in 1906 in Brownsville, Texas, there was abuse of there was a black military army unit, and they were discriminated against and brutalized by the local white trash. There was a riot, and the black soldiers came into town and fought with the whites, and Teddy Roosevelt ordered the entire battalion disbanded and these guys to be kicked out of the U.S. Army. A horrible thing that he did. He had some very strange attitudes towards race. He referred to the Chinese as the G-damn dirty Chinese and the Japanese, the plucky little Japs. And the reason that he intervened in the Russo-Japanese War was he couldn't tolerate the sight of a yellow race, the Japanese, defeating a white race, the Tsars, Russians, especially after the battles at Port Arthur and the defeat of the Russian Navy at the Battle of Tsushima Straits. And so he negotiated the peace treaty in New Hampshire between the Russians and the Japanese, and for that he got the Nobel Peace Prize. It's interesting, you're not hearing anything about Mr. Rowe's Peace Prize that he got when he became president. It's like it never happened. And if you've been to New York, you got to take a cab to get around. You don't want to rent a car and drive. But in 1907, the first New York taxi cab was set up. Service was set up. In 1919, one of the greatest racehorses of all time, Man of War, he only lost one race, and that was the year 1919 that he lost that race. You've had a lot of great American racehorses, Seabiscuit, some recent horses, lately in the 70s and the 80s. And it's a rich man's sport. Excuse me, I've got a slight cold. In 1950, 1933, President Eisenhower set up the Federal Government Contract Compliance Committee, and that was designed, that its purpose was to enforce employers who did business with the government to have non-discriminatory practices in their business, that they could not discriminate against anybody. And that compliance committee is supposedly still in effect today. And this is the unfortunate thing, the first thing that happened in the Kennedy administration in 1961. Khrushchev erected the Berlin, started to erect the Berlin Wall, and it was torn down about 10 years ago. Among the events today, I think this is important. I will bring this up next time. That Marilyn Monroe, she's thought of as only as a sex symbol, flaunting her body around. But she said some serious things. It was a good script in this film, Hometown Story, in which during the 50s again they raised this issue, and it was a legitimate issue about pollution and excessive corporate profits. It's not to say the corporation shouldn't make profits, but what is excessive? So that is the issue. But here is that clip from that film, which he played a secretary at a newspaper, small-town newspaper, and General Motors supposedly paid for part of the film. Now, where is Marilyn? Marilyn, where are you? oh, boy. I've got so many here, we screw up. Well, anyway, among the other things that are happening today, oh, here we go. Here, Marilyn Monroe. Of course, we also think of Marilyn singing Happy Birthday to President John Kennedy. And, of course, there were a few other things. But here in this film, before she met John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, she this was her dialogue in this film about respect. What happened here? Yeah, and I think in a way that's very appropriate for Marilyn Monroe, considering that she was just thought of and treated as just a shapely body. We're going to continue with our archival audio of Eric Hoffer, San Francisco longshoreman, author, political thinker. And this again is very relevant to what's going on today.
Was President Kennedy about as close, you would say, to a charismatic leader?
Yeah, but to me, you know, I had no feel for Kennedy. All you have to do is tabulate how many times Kennedy crossed the Atlantic and how many times he crossed the Appalachian Mountain. And you know where he belongs. And then tabulate the same thing with John. How many times he crossed the Atlantic and how many times he crossed the Appalachian Mountain.
When you talk to Johnson privately, you realize the core of his memory and thought is all with domestic American things.
Absolutely.
Foreign policy seems a great effort for him.
Well, when you get in the Middle West, there is no other world but America. See? We are so big that really foreign affairs don't count. And what the heck? Really, the only reason we are interested in domestic in foreign affairs is that we have to prevent a third world war. This is to me. This has been our foreign policy since the end of the last war.
Yeah.
How to prevent the Third World War? We are a learning people, Mr. Severine. You know, the immigrants came to this country. They had to learn a new language. They had to watch the game. We are a learning people. We learn. We learn from experience, about the only nation that learns from experience. And we have learned our lessons in 1930s. We know how Third World War starts and how to prevent it. See? And the way to prevent a third world war is to pick the potential bullet and get as close to him as possible and breathe down his neck until he settles down. And every one of us knows that if France and Britain had turned Spain and Ethiopia into Vietnam in the 1930s, if they had committed there all the atrocities we supposedly commit in Vietnam, if they made all the mistakes we supposedly are making in Vietnam, there wouldn't have been a Second World War, there wouldn't have been no Hitler, there wouldn't have been no gas chambers. You do not start a world war when a democracy throws its weight around chasing a bullet. World wars are started when the democracies are too unprepared, too cowardly, too reasonable, too frightened, or too
humanitarian, maybe.
Too tired, too humanitarian, I'm not going to tell Johnson what to do because I have faith in Johnson. Johnson will do the right thing. I've lived with Johnson all my life. I know that he'll do the right thing, and he'll figure as the great one of, let me go all the way, he'll figure as the foremost president of the 20th century.
You're saying that Johnson will be the foremost president of the
century? Absolutely. I'm convinced.
He's got to get
out.
He's got to get out of Vietnam one way or another, doesn't he?
We will find a solution to the Vietnam problem. We've never fought a war like that before. So we have to learn how to fight.
You think we could throw our weight around in the Middle East, for example, without making things worse?
Of course, we'll have to.
Have we not discharged our so-called moral obligation to Israel already many times over? How far does it go?
Well, Mr. Severide, you'll never, never, no country of the Occident will ever discharge its debt to Israel. Don't forget, Mr. Severide, the whole of the Occident was involved in the persecution, the humiliation, and the final annihilation of 6 million Jewish men, women, and children. Not one country, with all the open spaces that there are there in Brazil, in this country, in Australia, not one country threw its gates open to the Jews while escape was still possible. These Jews had to crawl on their knees to beg for visas. Not one country remonstrated with Hitler. Not one country broke diplomatic relations with him. We're all involved in it. And to me, Mr. Severide, I have a premonition. As it goes with Israel, so it will go with all of us. If Israel perishes, the Holocaust will be upon us. And history will cease to make any meaning to me. I wrote my first book in 1948. When the miracle of Israel happened. Imagine, after all these unimaginable suffering and degradation, comes the miracle of 1948, when a few thousand fugitives from Hitler's gas chambers got up on their hind legs and defied 40 million Arabs. I remember, I, barely literate, trying to write a book, trying to make sense of the enormity, and the calamities which have befallen us. And this miracle of Israel just put heart into me, Mr. Severide.
Really?
I felt that history can have meaning. History can make sense. But Israel must not perish, Mr. Severide. Must not. As far as I'm concerned, that's the end. If Israel perishes, there will be nothing to talk about, nothing to write about, nothing. Nothing will make any meaning anymore. History has to make some meaning.
Mr. Hoffer, why do you say this so-called Negro Revolution is a fraud in this country?
The Negro Revolution, if you watched it from the very beginning, it was used as an instrument by the Negro middle class, to fulfill its own desires. The leaders of the Negro Revolution have no faith in the Negro masses, no concern from them. It was used, as I tell you, by a relatively prosperous Negro middle class to attain its ends. Imagine a Negro revolution starting to move, and the first thing they worry about is desegregation. Who the hell needed desegregation except the Negro middle class who had a boy who they wanted to put in a special school? In other words, it was cut to the needs of the middle class. And the tragedy of it is that this so-called revolution not only didn't bring about any meaningful transformation of the Negro masses, but didn't give the Negro middle class what it wanted. The Negro middle class is just finding out. You see, this is the whole burden of it. See, the Negro middle class now will have to integrate itself with the Negro masses if the Negro is going to attain anything. Look, Mr. Severide, you ask any longshoreman what a Negro leader should do, and he'll tell you it's It's the most obvious thing that what a Negro leader should do is to dovetail the Negro's difficulties into opportunities for growth. Let me give you an example. You go to Chicago, you go to New York, you have the Negro slums, right? You have Negro unemployed. Now, what a Negro leader has to do is to train, mass training, of these Negro unemployed into skilled carpenters, masons, plasterers, plumbers, painters. He has to master the art of slum renovation. It's a whole art. It's a whole technique now developed. It's a beautiful technique. See? And then you organize these Negro workers into a solid black union. You understand? And then you renovate the slums. And you don't worry who owns the slums. You just go ahead and turn it into a garden. And after you have renovated the slums, you challenge the discriminating white unions to open up or get wiped out. And this is the way you get power.
How do the Negroes get the resources to renovate?
Oh, the resources. You don't need much resources and money floating around. I bet you, Mr. Severide, any time a Negro leader proposes this, what I propose now, the money will come flying to me from government, from private corporations. And they are just beginning to realize it. I've been saying that for years and years and years, Mr. Severide.
Well, now, what about some of these new young Negro leaders like Stokely Carmichael? They sound
there's nothing. They're all phonies.
But it's race hatred they're preaching.
Yeah, but who's going to listen to them? Maybe a few. They are not going to get anywhere because they have these naive conception of power. They say, power, power, give me power. Nobody can give you power. Power doesn't come in cans. When I hear Carmichael, he always asks me, give me the can opener, so I'll open the cans of power and eat them. See? And they're all phonies, these people. They do not realize that it's the long-term projects, things that you go about patiently and quietly that will achieve results. Look, once you have realized that, see, you are not going to waste your energies on hatred. You are not going to waste your energies on anything except building. I have been advocating, you know, to build yourself a community. Let me tell you something that happened. One day I came to Pier 35, I think it was. And there it was, on the wall, a poem. And I don't know whether it's good poetry, I don't know nothing about poetry, but the darn thing stuck into me, and I think this should be the anthem of the Negro. It was called Build Yourself a City. And here's how it went. Build yourself a city, found yourself a state, do not cry for pity, grab and master fate, grab a swamp and drain it, cut the log and plane it, make the hill the valley feel, and on the man-made plain, breathe your last complaint. Lay your shame, forget your name. Build, do not cry for pity. Build yourself a city. This is what I say. Build yourself a city. That everybody, any average American, sees that's what has to be done. You waste your energies on demonstrations, on riots. They do not produce one atom of pride. And now they are beginning to realize it, that the Negro has to do things by himself, that anything he is given will turn into wormwood and ashes in his mouth. You know, pride. Do you know the chemistry of pride, Mr. Severide? Pride. This is what the Negro needs. See?
That's what it's all about, isn't it?
That's it. And you don't get pride by having other people do your work for you or giving. And this is why I say now, the only hope for the Negro are these Negro veterans out of Vietnam. The tremendous performance of the Negroes in Vietnam, you know, has been generating a pride that's radiating across the Pacific and reaching into many Negro households. Vietnam is going to do the Negro what Israel has done for the Jews. See? They are proving themselves there. And if I was a Negro leader, I would pitch a tent on the water edge and grab those Negro veterans as they come back. They are the seed of the future. They are the kind of leaders that the Negro needs. The moment the Negro is proud of being a Negro, he'll cease being worrying about being a Negro. I told you that I think this is a great country because I can be a human being first and only secondly something else.
That was part four of the famous interview with Eric Severide, and which was part of our archives. And we'll have part five and excerpts in this because it's very important because the blacks, the thinking blacks, begin to realize they've been had by some of these so-called political leaders like, where is Stokely Carmichael today? Where are some of the others? Where is Jesse Jackson? I could tell you stories about that one. This is an allegation that although Sandusky has been convicted of pedophilia and all of that, There's an allegation that he's being investigated for possible links to other pedophiles in a ring, and we've heard this from other sources. And to end our political animal, American political animals, Davis Ryan, would be the third Roman Catholic to be vice president. The first one, who was born and baptized Roman Catholic, was a Native American Indian, Charles Curtis, who was Republican, lawyer, and he was an economic conservative. He was the vice president in the Herbert Hoover administration. There's some interesting analogies that can be drawn between Romney and Hoover. Of course, Joe Biden, Roman Catholic, although we wonder about him, second Roman Catholic to be vice president. And then if the Romney Ryan ticket is elected, Paul Davis Ryan will be the third. So we'll be back Wednesday. This is Peter Paul Brazola, and we'll end with our usual theme, politics and poker. So I guess somebody had the winning hand. I guess it was Paul Ryan. And I don't know if he's a poker player, but let's end with our usual politics and poker, and we'll get some reaction to the Ryan selection from our Midwest correspondent.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what
are
you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Well, if Paul Ryan is elected vice president, he's already on the ticket, on the ballot in Wisconsin, because he had to sign up for November election. So they'll have to pick a candidate to succeed him, if that candidate, a Republican, presumably will win. And, of course, we'll be getting into the gasoline increase, the spike at the pumps, profiteering at the pump, some people said. So we'll be back Wednesday. This is Peter Paul Brazola, and go to our Amicus Veritas YouTube site, AmicusVeritas YouTube, or go to brazola.com for our blog, verzola.com. Good night.